This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in. Coming up, two of our reporters share more on some stories they've been working on. One about county health officials' involvement in the state's contact tracing efforts. Are we using our local experts enough in that effort? And a unique gardening business brought on by the pandemic seems to be taking off. And later, we'll find out just how badly Indianapolis and Fort Wayne rank on the nation, on the list of the nation's fittest cities, and how they might do better. But first, we'll start as we always do with a look at the big headlines from the past week with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. Let's look at the numbers from the COVID-19 pandemic. What do we know today?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 2,610 people have died from COVID-19 in Indiana. There are more than 54,000 confirmed cases and more than 504,000 Hoosiers have been tested. To compare that to last week, 2,555 people had died. There are more than 50,000 confirmed and more than 550,000 Hoosiers had been tested. So that trend of the decrease in deaths per week has continued, but we are seeing a new spike in cases. This week alone, we saw 4,513 new cases, with five of the last 8 days of more than 700 new cases. So that's really alarming to the state. And for all of those reasons, the governor announced Wednesday the state will remain in stage 4.5 through the end of July.
We had a great show yesterday with an epidemiologist talking about, you know, the current state of things and why we might want to do what we're doing, which is, again, pausing on stage 4.5 through July. Do we know any more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, Indiana was set to move into its final phase this weekend after we had paused the weekend of July 4th. But because of several COVID-19 metrics, including higher percentages of positive tests and more hospitalizations, are all trending in the wrong direction. So the governor said, along with holding steady on current restrictions, for instance, 75% capacity at restaurants, 50% capacity at bars, nightclubs, and other entertainment venues. The state will also require organizers of any event with more than 250 people to get approval for their COVID-19 safety plans from local health departments. All that being said, Holcomb also isn't imposing a statewide mask-wearing mandate. During the press conference Wednesday, State Health Commissioner Chris Bock said that she hopes this new wave of cases and hospitalizations push people to wear masks and socially distance, that this is kind of a wake-up call for folks.
All right. And related to the pandemic, of course, the economic fallout from the pandemic has hit the state's pocketbook pretty hard. What do we know?
Yeah, so the state officially closed its fiscal year and faced a $900 million hole in its finances in the fiscal year. The state is covering that shortfall through cuts to state agencies, federal help, and budget reserves, meaning that we have $1.4 billion still left in state coffers, frequently referred to as the rainy day fund. Budget officials estimate Indiana took a hit of nearly $600 million in the last fiscal year from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. That was seen, for instance, in sales tax and gaming revenues that fell far short of expectations. Yet a big chunk of the budget shortfall can actually be traced to tax day getting moved from April to July 15th, which means the state should still collect a lot of that money. That makes things a little more sunny for the next fiscal year, but the state's budget director said Indiana will need to make more austere budgets as a result. And officials said state agencies were able to save money by leaving vacant positions unfilled and renegotiating contracts, but did so in a way that did not cut services.
And I didn't hear as much with, I guess, this week as I would have any normal year, the week of April 15th, about people getting their taxes done at the last minute. Have you heard anything?
I mean, I always file my taxes on the second to last day before a deadline, and this year is no different. I don't know why. It's never really a problem, but it's always what I do. I'm a journalist through and through. I procrastinate on deadline.
We are motivated by deadlines for sure. I know I am the same way. So along those lines, unemployment insurance benefits that extra money's going to end.
Yeah. The Indiana Department of Workforce Development will stop issuing that additional $600 to recipients of unemployment benefits on July 25th. That $600 expires at the end of the month due to a provision in the Federal CARES Act. If unemployed workers file for benefits on or before July 25th, DWD said it will make the additional payments. But unless Congress provides additional relief, the maximum Hoosiers could get in unemployment assistance would decrease to, at most, $390 per week. We've heard from folks who filed for unemployment who've been waiting for months to receive benefits as a result of a backlog of claims that are still being processed, which has been exacerbated by fraudulent claims the DWD say are from foreign identity thieves.
Oh my gosh! With everything else that they have to keep track of right now, it's a wonder that they found that in the first place. Mm-hmm. Pretty incredible. All mm-hmm. right, let's get away from COVID-19 if we possibly can. Do we have anything that's not COVID-19 related?
We very much do. And peek behind the screen for folks at home. Matt does an incredible kindness to me by sending me a list of stories he's found interesting and thought I would talk about for the show ahead of our conversations.
Even though you're the one in the know and not me.
Hey, you know what? The wild guess is like, oh, yeah, no, that is interesting. But when I saw the story list today, I had totally forgotten about this story, that it had happened within the last week, that it existed. It's just been so much a part of my reality that I was just like, oh, yeah, no. And Todd Rokita is the AG nominee.
Well, it was, to be fair to you, it was almost exactly a week ago that we found out. It was like the end of the day last Friday, right?
Yeah. And for about an hour of time, I was supposed to be doing the broadcast story. So you would think that I would have remembered it, but I didn't. And that's fine. So the big details, the GOP convention decided on former Secretary of State and U.S. Representative Todd Rokita to be the Attorney General nominee for the Republicans. Rokita served two terms as Secretary of State and four in Congress before an unsuccessful bid for U.S. Senate. And he was the most direct of GOP candidates in attacking Curtis Hill, who he called wounded and said the embattled incumbent put the office at risk. Hill, who criminally battered four women in 2018, lost a narrow vote by party delegates. Hill faced three Republican challengers amid a suspension of his law license by the Indiana Supreme Court.
And I wish we had Brandon Smith here to talk with us about this, because he, of course, has been following this very, very closely ever since the very beginning of this controversy with Curtis Hill. So we may very well speak with him before too long about this. But does Todd Rokita's nomination come as any surprise to you as someone who's followed the news?
You know, I was, it's hard to be shocked because anything would have been shocking, right? Like, no matter what way the convention had decided, it was going to be a surprise. It was truly, well and truly a toss-up between any of the candidates, especially between Curtis Hill and Todd Rokita. So it was definitely an interesting decision, to be sure, and especially the reaction. Brandon and I did a fairly substantial web story, especially with the reaction from how Democrats are pivoting to focus on Todd Rokita and how Republican allies of Rokita were responding to his nomination. It all seemed like everybody was a little bit surprised.
Well, that's a very good point, that every result that could have possibly happened would have been a surprise. Had it been Rokita, the surprise is, of course, that an incumbent lost the position. Mm-hmm. Curtis Hill, had he gotten it, the surprise would be that he had gotten it despite the allegations. And had anyone else gotten it, it would have been a surprise that it wasn't her, Hill or Rokita. Mm-hmm. An astute observation, to be sure. In other state government news, we have a big retirement from the Indiana House.
Yeah, former Indiana House Speaker Brian Bosma officially retired. He's leaving his state house seat at the end of this month. Bosma's departure has been in the works for months since he announced the 2020 session would be his last. So it's not a surprise if you're paying attention to it as much as some of us on the statewide reporting team have been. If you are surprised, welcome. Bosma is the longest serving speaker in Indiana history, with 12 years leading the Indiana House of Representatives. He announced last November that 2020 would be his last session and put together a plan for his departure. And a private Republican caucus will choose the replacement for Bosma to serve out the last few months of his term. It will likely be Chris Jeter, who won the GOP primary for Bosma's seat last month.
And do you even know what there is to do with the General Assembly for the rest of the year? not in session.
Yeah, summer study committees still happen.
Of course.
Yeah, those are the most important things that happen at the General Assembly.
All right. And so we are also looking at adding some people to the list of the Indiana 2020 two-way. What are we still doing with the two-way?
You know, this week we talked about environmental justice and environmental racism. It was an incredible conversation that we had on Facebook. I highly recommend going back and watching it. And that was inspired because of feedback that we received from the Indiana 2020 two-way. So to join, text elections to 73224. We're going to talk about COVID. We're going to talk about the election, but we're also going to talk about the things that impact people in Indiana. So that means environmental justice. That means all sorts of education topics. And that means everything in between.
All right. She is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. And by the way, her hair really couldn't be any cooler right now. Check the Twitter profile. I'm serious. Lauren Chapman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, some Indiana County health officials say we'd be doing a much better job with contact tracing if we just gave them the resources to help out. After all, they're used to this kind of work. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back with that in just over 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Just looking at the numbers, Indiana's response to COVID-19 has been better than some states, not quite as good as others, but overall not bad. When it comes to contact tracing, some local health officials say we could be doing a lot better. For one thing, maybe we could ask them for help or advice on how to do it right. Brock Turner is rural affairs reporter for WFIU in Bloomington, and he's been looking into contact tracing. Brock, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Admittedly, I don't really think that much about local health departments. Statewide and federal responses to the pandemic kind of suck up all the attention, but the locals have been pretty busy too, right? What are they doing?
They definitely have been busy. So before this pandemic really ramped up and became the statewide emergency that it is, a lot of local health departments were sort of working this disease no differently than any other disease that they work with, especially in regards to contact tracing. That's something local health departments have been tasked with really since their inception, to be able to find communicable diseases and trace people who might have been come in contact. So that could be anything from a local restaurant that has some sort of foodborne illness outbreak to HIV, hepatitis, to anything. So they were really on the front lines and still are on the front lines of fighting this disease and chipping away at this pandemic. And a lot of the state directives go through them as well.
So when the state wanted to implement a bigger contact tracing effort for COVID-19, they asked local health departments for their input. Did they hear anything back?
Yeah, they did hear back, and a lot of the local health departments had plenty of opinions, at least the ones that I spoke with. I think the biggest things that they heard back were that local health departments were just overwhelmed with the number of cases coming in. I mean, you know, in small counties, yeah, they might have been able to handle it where they had, you know, one or two cases a day coming in. But larger counties, you know, at the height of this pandemic, they were getting, you know, hundreds of cases coming in at times. And especially if you had an outbreak at a meatpacking facility, for example, or a large congregated setting. I mean, I think to Decatur County, where there were hundreds of people infected at a sectional basketball game, that would quickly overwhelm a local health department in a small rural community. And even a larger county like Marion County, they didn't have the staff and still don't have the staff to be able to require and have the resources to conduct contact tracing at the level that they would need to. So the state came in and said, we're going to help you out. We're going to set up this centralized call center to handle with contact tracing and deal with it. But there were some questions about that.
Did the state take local health departments' advice?
I think yes and no. A lot of the local health departments that I spoke with said that, for this story, said that they were really thankful for the support. The state call center kept local health departments from having to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day on this. But I think the other side of that coin is a lot of local health departments also say that they just wanted to be more involved in the process and that they had given their input, but the state didn't really take it. So, you know, it's six of one, half dozen of another, I guess.
How is the state missing the mark on contact tracing?
So there are really, I think, three major issues in terms of what the state's doing and what they're not doing correctly. The first of that is with the quality of tracing reports. And there are sort of two layers to the quality of these reports. The first is that 20% of positive cases across the state, Indiana Health Department officials can't get a hold of people. The term that they use is called loss to contact. So basically, if I get a positive test, if I test positive, Matt, and there are five of me, the state won't be able to get a hold of one person. So one in five people, the state is not able to get a hold of at all. And obviously, if you can't get a hold of that person, you can't find out who they talked to, what restaurants they went into. And it's really difficult to sort of build that web out, which is the entire point of contact tracing. The other portion of that is for the four in five that the state is being able to get in touch with, a lot of those cases, officials tell me about half of those cases are missing vital information. So again, we're not really getting a whole picture of what's going on within the individual. So, you know, maybe they have that I lived with a roommate or two or have a family and saw a family, but they didn't get where I worked, or they didn't get that I, you know, went to church or, you know, visited a restaurant. So they're missing vital information, at least what local health officials call vital information, on those files, and those files are marked complete. The last thing has to do with a little more in-depth and sort of in the weeds piece, but it's how quickly contact tracers are getting a positive test. So officials have told me that there are significant delays between when the test is completed at the lab and then when that gets reported out to the contact tracing agency or local health departments.
So if it were up to some of the people you talked to who were health officials at the local level there, what would they have done?
They say that they really just honestly would have liked a pile of money from the state and given the resources to be able to do it at the local level. Now, granted, there are positives and negatives to having that happen. But I think state official or the local officials that I spoke with have just said, you know, the results of this are not really acceptable and make it really difficult to be able to trace properly. And I think, you know, it underscores this with the importance. Kayla Hostetler is the administrator at the Tippecanoe County Health Department, and here she is talking about just the overall importance of contact tracing.
It's so important. It's the most important piece. So if it's not done well, we can't stop the spread of COVID-19. You can wear a mask and you can have mitigation strategies all you want. But if you're not stopping and quarantining people when they have a known exposure, you're not going to stop the spread of COVID-19. It's so poorly done that my staff member would not have a job if this was their quality of work.
So, Matt, there's a lot of stuff there, but I think local health departments are clearly thankful for, you know, the support that they've gotten from ISDH. But with the $43 million that the state health department spent on the centralized call center for contact tracing, local health departments think they probably could have gotten better results if they just handled it themselves.
How does it seem Indiana's efforts are comparing to other states?
That's really a big question, and I don't know that there's a great answer for what that looks like. But Indiana, just the way that we're set up, is we're set up as a home rule state. So local departments have a lot of power. There are 91 different local health departments or county health departments in the state of Indiana, a couple local health departments. But essentially, every county in the state of Indiana has their own health department. So, you know, you're creating, you know, 91 different ways to do something, 91 staffs, 91 administrators. So it can be difficult to get everyone synced up and share information, which, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the things that's happening. So I think just the way Indiana is set up from a government perspective, a local government perspective, makes this difficult. It also gives us some interesting strengths in that, you know, local health departments are going to understand the local communities that they're in. They're going to likely have a finger on the pulse of what's going on in their communities better than, for example, you know, if a state office would just, you know, have multiple districts, you know, and slice a state up in that way. So there are pros and cons to Indiana's approach. There's not a lot of good data that really can confirm one way or the other, you know, how Indiana is doing. And officials do tell me that as the state begins to open up, it can be a lot more difficult to contact trace. So, you know, we're not seeing great results now, but as people, you know, begin to get out of their houses and go and do more things and more things open up, it's going to be a lot harder.
Do you plan to keep looking into this?
Absolutely, Matt. I don't think this story is going away. This story, I think, goes away when the pandemic goes away. You know, it'll be really interesting to see that the state says they're aware of a lot of these issues and that they're really working hard to try and fix this. So, you know, I will definitely keep following it and stay in touch.
Brock Turner reports on rural affairs for WFIU in Bloomington. Brock, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
And now for a positive pandemic story, which is among the stranger phrases I've ever uttered. It's a story about being laid off and how it can kick one's entrepreneurial spirit into higher gear. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton joins me now. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so a lot of people lost work when the state shut down, including people in my own family. We all know people have been furloughed. A lot of folks are too familiar now with how unemployment insurance works. What happened with the subject of your story?
Yeah, so Claudia Capuano is out of Lafayette, Indiana, up near Purdue University. And she was working at a local restaurant called La Scala, an Italian restaurant there in Lafayette downtown. And like a lot of restaurant workers, got furloughed with stay-at-home orders that pushed restaurant workers into kind of in this weird waiting pattern until things could reopen back up. And so that's how it kind of all started for her, was knowing what was coming, but then also figuring out what to do then with all that time that she would have not working at the restaurant.
So what did she do?
So yeah, she started a business, which is something that it sounds very weird when you think about it at first. You're like, what, you start a business during the pandemic?
It does. It's
not a very common thing, but she saw a need that she felt that she could help the community address, as well as people being interested possibly in wanting it. So she started a gardening business. And to give a background on her, she has worked on farms in the past, and she also had been helping with management at the restaurant. So she had this background in gardening as well as kind of how to manage people. And so she took a group of furloughed workers from the restaurant that she worked with and helped kind of get them doing something that maybe didn't necessarily pay as well as what they would make at the restaurant, but something that could maybe help offset some of that expense that they would have right now.
So she knew what she was doing. She knew how to find help as well, which is kind of hard to find sometimes. So she had that going for her. But, I mean, was this a big investment up front? Did she have to rent out space or a storefront?
No, so when I visited her, I met her at first at one of the sites when they were putting in garden beds, and she asked me if I want to go back to see the essentially home base for this operation. I was like, yeah, this sounds great. And we went there, and it was right outside her apartment. She uses her apartment essentially as the home base of this operation. So there's plants like grow that she has that are growing next to her apartment. There's a shed where she has other ones growing that need maybe more shade. They use the church parking lot right next door, which they've gotten permission to use from the church to build the beds, which they'll do in a mass production and then store them away. The operation did not necessarily need an office space or anything. But it is very much where she has taken what she has and made that work.
I mean, was this particular business idea, was it something she had been thinking about doing for a while?
Yeah, she wanted some sort of business in the realm of farming. So when I first started talking to her, she mentioned how originally I believe her plan was a little bit more of a babysitter for people who already own farms. So let's say they had a baby or death in the family or something, she could come in and help manage the farm for a short while they handled whatever personal issue or challenge they had at that time. Giving them essentially a break was the idea. So that was originally what she wanted to do, but she started thinking, what if we help people be able to grow their own food in this community and be more self-sufficient? So that's where she pivoted her idea a little bit. And some of those elements are still very much in that model, but it's a similar idea of let's help people with gardens and grow food locally.
And the name of the business goes along with that first idea. What is it again?
Yeah, it's Bot and Annie. So if you're someone who loves puns, it is very, very much right up your alley.
Did she share whether she was anxious about this? I mean, it seems like this kind of business wouldn't require a lot of initial investment or anything.
Yeah, no, I don't think she had a lot of anxiety about it. For her, it was a lot at first just about filling time and doing something, giving back. She saw it as more giving back to the community. So she was, in her mind, yes, there's cost to build these gardens, but she's also helping people rely on themselves and not have to worry about, do I go to the grocery store this week and not find the items I'm looking for on the shelves, which a lot of people have become all too familiar with the past few months. So I think she knew that she was going to have some interest, but on the flip side, she did not expect to see the interest that she saw. I think that surprised her overall. She just planned to kind of make this as a side thing and just do it slowly. But when I talked with Claudia, she talked a lot about how there was a surge of demand all of a sudden for these garden beds because she does container gardens for people who don't maybe have the yard space to put the garden beds in. So she's kind of made it adaptable for people's different lifestyles. And so she was building, at one point, they were building dozens of beds in that church parking lot and were almost on a back order to meet the demands that they were getting of orders of people wanting these garden beds. And I think, at least from the customer I spoke with, she used her stimulus check to get the garden. So I think the timing was really smart for Claudia. It worked out. And also the fact that people are home all the time now. We've seen reporting done on home improvement projects being up. When you're in your home space for so much time, working and living there, you want to maybe start investing some of the money maybe you spent otherwise back into your home.
And so, I don't know. It sounds like it's doing well. Has it paid off?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as profitable as if she was still working her job at the restaurant. So, and the restaurant La Scala hasn't reopened yet as of the last time I talked to her. But yeah, it's doing the demand's there. People are interested. And it's not just about building the garden beds. The other part of her business that she's added in is helping people with growing it. Part of the cost that people can pay and have as a service is her helping them then grow the vegetables, or now they've expanded to flower beds too. So she's helping adjust people to helping do this because gardening can be hard. I'm saying this as I, and I bet many people have had plants where they've either, didn't water it enough or overwatered it and just killed it. She has people who are very intent, from what I've gathered, who want to continue doing this, and the fact that she's there to help them is making this business model, at least as of right now, look like it's going to continue and not just be a fad, so to speak.
So it sounds like she was able to take from her original idea and combine it with some new ideas. And gosh, I could use her help. I've killed succulents in my house before, which is hard to do. But if she gets called back to work, last time you talked to her, the restaurant hadn't reopened. If she gets called back, has she said whether or not she'll go?
From what I've gotten from her, she definitely is not planning on ending the Bot and Annie business. That is, she is determined now after seeing the interest people have had and interest not just in the Lafayette area. She recently had interest from in the Indianapolis area here too, which is an hour away. So people are really intrigued by this. So she's planning on seeing this business through. As for La Scala, she hasn't shut that door yet. I think it's something that's still kind of all up in the air when I talked with her. I think she's just really set on continuing this and then figuring out how her business then fits into her working at the restaurant.
Samantha Horton covers business and economic issues for Indiana Public Broadcasting. She originally reported this story late last month for Indiana Public Broadcasting and NPR nationally. Sam, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, Indianapolis and Fort Wayne are among the nation's least fit cities. We'll talk with the head of the college that puts out this list every year. Ironically, she's from Indy and has a lot to say about how Indiana's two largest cities could improve its health and fitness rankings. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indianapolis and Fort Wayne have found their way onto the American Fitness Index, 100 U.S. cities ranked by factors like health behaviors, chronic diseases, and public infrastructure. The index is put out every year by the American College of Sports Medicine. Yes, our two largest cities made the list, but they didn't get good marks. Of the 100 cities listed, Fort Wayne is number 92, and Indianapolis is even worse off at 94. Here to talk with us about how they determine the rankings and how our cities might do better is the president of the American College of Sports Medicine. She's also a research scientist with Regan Sreef Institute and a professor of kinesiology at IUPUI. Nicole Keith. Professor Keith, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And you live in the greater Indianapolis area, right?
I live in Indianapolis in Wayne Township.
And has Indy ever done well with this list?
Unfortunately, no. We've been doing the American Fitness Index for 13 years. This is our 13th. And Indianapolis has always ranked in the bottom 5 to 10 cities.
And so what are we doing wrong, or what are we not doing, perhaps?
I think that in general, people are really paying attention to their health. And so one thing everybody should keep in mind is the ACSM Anthem American Fitness Index is looking at 100 cities, and 100 cities are competing with each other to be healthier and to provide a better infrastructure and better opportunities to be healthy and active for their cities. So as we're getting better, other cities are getting better as well. So I want to frame it in that context. So one good thing I can say about Fort Wayne and Indianapolis, for Fort Wayne, about 77% of their residents say that they're exercising in the last 30 days. And for Indianapolis, it's about 71%. That's great. But in order to improve health outcomes, you have to exercise enough. And neither of the people living in these cities are doing that. And so for Indianapolis, it's about 19%. And for Fort Wayne, it's about 18%. And so while people are exercising, they're just not exercising enough.
So would it be practical to improve our ranking by just encouraging more exercising, either at home or at a gym, or do we need to do more than that?
If only that worked, Matt, but it doesn't. So also included in that personal health rank score or personal behaviors is the percent of people biking and walking to work. And for both cities, it's about 2%. And the people using public transportation for work. And the same thing, it's remarkable how similar Indianapolis and Fort Wayne are, but they're about 2% too. And so really it is up to our cities to build the infrastructure to help people be more active and fit activity into their daily lives. Because one of the barriers is that people don't have time to fit physical activity into their daily lives. But if they could build in physical activity as part of their transportation to school or to work or to the grocery store, it would be better. And when we look at both cities for their bike scores, so how bikeable a community is, does it have bike lanes? Does it have traffic calming measures to protect cyclists? The bike scores are 45 for Indianapolis and about 47 for Fort Wayne. And then in terms of walk scores, they're even lower in both communities. And so for both communities, the walk score is about 29. And this is out of 100. And so in terms of sidewalks, it's the same thing as bike lanes, except for are the sidewalks connected? Can you reach a destination by a sidewalk? And the scores are pretty low. So it's really up to the city that throughout the city, I'm not as familiar with Fort Wayne, but downtown Indianapolis is great. It's really walkable. It's really bikeable. But then as you start to branch out to communities, surrounding communities or to the suburbs, it's not easy to actively transport from those locations into the central part of the city. So it really is up to the city planners and city leaders to make it more accessible by bike or by walking.
But now, if I remember correctly, Indianapolis started drastically improving its bikeability and walkability, I guess, at around the time of your first American Fitness Index, about 13 years ago. It sounds like those improvements haven't really counted for much, or perhaps we just haven't gone far enough.
Yeah, so I think that the latter is true, and I would add transportation to that. I had said earlier that public transportation is a really important way to get people more active, too, because they have to either walk to the public transportation or walk from it to their destination. So I would add that Indianapolis has done well in all three of those areas in terms of improving, but we need to go further.
And so, I don't know, Indianapolis is kind of a big city in that it covers a lot of ground. It's a big area. So then are we at a disadvantage because of that, because it costs money to add this infrastructure like bike lanes and longer sidewalks that go all the way out to the suburbs?
Well, the city that does the best is Minneapolis, and Indianapolis isn't bigger than Minneapolis.
Yeah, that kind of sprawl there, huh?
and they were able to create trails around the perimeter of downtown Minneapolis, and then also create trails that go out to the communities that surround Minneapolis. And what I would also say is that people like to blame the weather. And again, Minneapolis has more extreme weather than Indianapolis. So that's not it either.
So how do we determine that factor, the extreme weather factor? Is it just the cold that happens there, or is something else at work?
No, it's just, I mean, we're not really measuring weather. We just know that Minneapolis has skin freeze warnings in the wintertime. We don't. And so we don't typically have that. So we know it just gets colder in Minneapolis than it does in Indianapolis. And some people would say, oh, well, other cities are doing better because they have better weather. And that's not it either.
So people in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne need to participate in more physical activity. So does this need to be a drastic lifestyle change for a lot of people, or does just a little more go a long way, would you say?
Every minute of physical activity counts. But I also just kind of want to say that the Anthem, American College of Sports Medicine Fitness Index, looks at more than just personal behavior. So part of it is on us and eating more fruits and vegetables each day. We do really well with the fruit part. We're not doing so well with the vegetable part. But we also have to look at part of the Anthem American Fitness Index. It looks at the community and environment rank score. So I talked about the bike and walk score. But we have to look at what we have in terms of a green space. And so what the parks are, and also looking at policies. And so one thing that I noticed that really stood out to me is in terms of being within a 10-minute walk of a park, both Boston, Massachusetts, and San Francisco are really great in that 100% of their residents are within a 10-minute walk of a park. And for Fort Wayne, it's about 50%. And for Indianapolis, it's 35%. So this is another way to encourage people to be active. It really is important for community leaders to understand that if you're providing opportunities for people to be more physically active in parks is another way, the likelihood that that's going to happen. And so it's not just telling them, but it's also providing them with the opportunity to do so. Another policy that's really important is park expenditure per resident. And when you look at the number one city for park expenditures, again, it's Minneapolis, and they're spending $263 per resident. Fort Wayne's spending $67 per resident, and Indianapolis is spending $36 per resident. The average around the 100 cities is $99. So Fort Wayne is closer to that number. Indianapolis has a long way to go. So investing in the health of our residents is also very important.
We are talking to the president of the American College of Sports Medicine and a research scientist with Regenstrief Institute, Nicole Keith. And we're talking about the American Fitness Index, the 100 U.S. cities ranked by factors like health behaviors, chronic diseases, and public infrastructure. Indianapolis and Fort Wayne did not do great on this year's list and haven't in the past, it sounds like. How do you determine this list of 100 cities? I mean, are you just looking at the 100 biggest cities and then ranking them on that list, or does more go into it?
That's it. So we're looking at the largest 100 cities. And for people who have been following this for a long time, we changed about 3 years ago to only include the 100 largest cities. Before, we were looking at metropolitan statistical areas. So for Indianapolis, it would have been Indianapolis and Carmel. And so it was just looking at what is considered a metropolitan statistical area. And what we noticed is cities were scoring really high that had urban areas that were quite impoverished. And so what we were communicating to those city leaders and policymakers is, you're doing really well. When in actuality, if you look at Indianapolis is very different than Carmel in terms of who lives there and what kind of assets the community provides. So we decided to separate those out and just have the 100 largest cities. And so people get really excited, oh, we made the list, but we didn't make the list because we're in the top 100 in terms of our fitness behaviors. We made the list because we're in the top 100 in terms of population density.
Okay. So coming back to the public investment talk, and Indianapolis has a long way to go. Fort Wayne, not as much, but it's below the average. What about sports facilities, like specific sports facilities like ball diamonds or swimming pools? I mean, we seem to have a decent amount of those. Does that factor in at all?
So the American Fitness Index includes recreation facilities, and we look at ball diamonds, basketball, hoops, park playgrounds, rec centers, swimming pools, as you mentioned, and tennis courts per 10,000 residents. And nobody's doing well. The average is between one and two per 10,000 residents. And it's really important for people to recognize it's great to have those amenities in the community. But when I think about recreation facilities, I do think of them as being amenities. Very few people use them. There's a very small percentage of the population that plays baseball or basketball or who will take time out to use a rec center. And that's why it's really important, while I call those recreational facilities amenities, to understand that having bike lanes is not an amenity, or having green space or walkable sidewalks. These are no longer considered amenities. These are necessary to the public health outcomes of community residents. And so, great, kids should be able to play, adults should be able to play. But if we're thinking about how to spend investment dollars, the number of people who can access a sidewalk compared to a number of people who would access a swimming pool is really different.
So Indiana, I almost said Indianapolis, but Indiana likes to tout their trail system. And Indianapolis has a pretty decent trail system, too. We have the Cultural Trail, the Monon, and several others. I mean, does that factor in? How could that be better?
It absolutely factors in. And I agree that Indiana in general, the trail systems are pretty amazing, but they don't go everywhere and they're not all connected. And I think when we were talking about Minneapolis earlier, the plan needs to happen so that they are connected. I know that many trails are built on old railways, and it's really important. Those were connected. So it's really important to figure out a way to continue to connect these trail systems, because it's not just for people who like to go jogging or recreationally bike. It's another transportation path so that people can get to from one place to another. And yes, it absolutely counts, but we're looking at utilization and we're also looking at connectivity. And if they're not useful and they're not connected, and the only reason people would get on it is for recreation or for exercise, then the likelihood that we're going to increase the number of people using it is slim to none.
So Indy and Fort Wayne have a long way to go. And so we need to take a few steps, I guess, toward that direction. What would be some good first steps we could take?
So I think the first steps is we can all take personal responsibility to try and fit those 150 minutes of physical activity into our daily routine, or into our weekly routine, sorry. And just adding more activity, walking to destinations instead of driving if you can, and just fitting more activity, but also understanding what counts as activity. So if you get your heart rate up and you're using your large muscle groups, that's considered physical activity. So walking, but also if you're gardening or if you're mopping or sweeping, as long as your heart rate's getting up, it's counting towards physical activity. These are all self-report. So making sure that you're accurately capturing what you're doing in terms of physical activity. So that's in terms of personal behavior. Something easy, eat more vegetables, because we're not doing really well. Only 15% of Indianapolis residents consume vegetables, and it's 16% for Fort Wayne residents. So some personal things that we can do: stop smoking, or if you don't smoke, don't start. But in terms of policymakers, we spent a lot of time today talking about bike and walk scores and city parks. Fort Wayne is not doing bad in terms of farmers markets. There are actually 18 farmers markets per 1 million residents. And when we break that down, Fort Wayne has 22 per 1 million residents. DC has 82.6, but even though 22 is good, it's better than the national average in terms of farmers markets. For Indianapolis, we're below the national average. So it's 18.7, we're at 16.1. So Indianapolis could create more farmers markets. And compared to when we first started doing this, Indianapolis does have many more farmers markets, but we could do more. It would hit physical activity and nutrition if you got together with your neighborhood community and developed a farmers market, because it takes work to plant and to maintain a green space. And then in terms of infrastructure, investing in our infrastructure and park expenditure is something that should happen as well.
She is the president of the American College of Sports Medicine. She's also a research scientist at Regenstrief Institute and a professor of kinesiology at IUPUI. Nicole Keith, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director, and he composed our theme. Our podcasts can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. Follow us for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and maybe take a walk. This is All In.